Hello, and welcome to Cannock Chase Collections, the podcast where guests get to share their local history stories and knowledge of local objects, places, and events. These collections are packed with treasures from our past, from coal mining and early industries to military memories, photography, social history, and even objects that remind us how being a part of community life contributes to health and well-being. I'm Rachel New, and this week is all about glass, from the hidden history of the medieval glass industry to the stories behind the stained glass you can still see in Cannock today.
My name's Spencer Houghton. I'm a research historian working for the collections department.
So we're talking glass today, Spencer, and I think there's a lot of people from this area who don't even know that there is a huge glass history.
People from this area automatically think of the Cannock Chase area as a coal mining area, which indeed it was. Prior to that, there was quite an extensive iron industry here. But again, going back into earlier medieval period, we're talking about quite a substantial glass manufacturing industry here.
And how was that discovered?
Remarkably, two main finds. One was on Baggots Park, which is just to the north of Rugeley. They were clearing rough grazing and they found some structures under the ground, and then they brought the archaeologists in, who discovered anything up to 18 different furnaces. But the one actually sat on Cannock Chase was at Wolseley Park, Little Birches, the actual area is called. They were just developing the site for a quarry, and when they got the big diggers in, they discovered something under the ground that they didn't know what it was. So again, called in the archaeologists, and Dr. Chris Walsh led the archaeological dig on it and discovered both an early medieval glass kiln there and also a 16th century glass kiln there.
We're talking kind of 13 something or other for the medieval one?
Yeah, I mean, it's looked at something around about late 13th century right the way through to the 14th and 15th century. And then the second kiln that they found at Wolseley Bridge was much later. That was in the early 16th century.
What was this glass being made for and where was it going?
Medieval, sort of Tudor times, it was for the rich only, and more importantly to the ecclesiastical market. So the real find for us here was discovering that 16 windows in York Minster have got Rugeley glass in them. So that would have been taken from Rugeley via the Trent up to the Ouse. You meet at the Humber and then up onto New York. And again, that was really exciting to find out that we had glass in such a prestigious venue like York Minster.
Wow, and just thinking of that journey as well, of course, pre-canals, the only way to do it would have been by water, but a very circuitous route, because it would have been a fragile thing to be transporting.
There was no way they could transport it by medieval roads on the back of a horse and cart. It probably wouldn't have made it through to Lichfield, as let alone up to York. So yeah, the rivers were very much more navigable than they are today.
These finds, I mean, we've actually got some bits of... Is this furnace kiln? What are we looking at here?
For those who aren't here looking at it, it looks like a lump of concrete rubble, basically. But it isn't. It's a very important find. It's from the South Kiln on the Little Birches site, and it's part of what they call a siege, which was a shelf within the kiln where large pottery crucibles would be sat, and the melt... All the glass products were put into these crucibles and melted at high temperatures. And what we're looking at here is one of the tops of the sieges, and you can see on there all the little shards of molten glass that had sort of bubbled up out of the crucible and dripped all over the shelf there.
It's amazing, actually, and the glass is a kind of pale green, very beautiful. I don't know if it's supposed to be pale green or if it's pale green because it reacted with whatever it dripped on, but it's amazing to touch it and to think that it's 700 plus years old.
The colour of it, early medieval glass was very green. It was called forest glass. And then as technology developed, it was coming out clearer and clearer, so that by the time this was really in operation, late 15th, 16th century, it was pretty clear glass.
What would it have looked like in operation? What would this area have looked like, a glass area?
A mess. The actual kilns themselves were probably about 4 metres long by about 2 metres wide. They were sort of an arched tunnel. Both ends would have had little brick entrances, one to shove stuff in and the other one to shove stuff out. Then over the top of that would have been a open-sided wooden structure, almost like a roof, to keep it away from the bad weather, because obviously the heat, they wanted to maintain the heat. Made of sandstone, very substantial. I've actually seen the remnants of this kiln that we've got here, and it is very large and very heavy. There were lots of spoil sites on the site, which gave huge amounts of information to the archaeologists. There wasn't much environmental friendly activity going on at the time. It was literally shoveling stuff in and shoveling stuff out and piling it up, ready for the next one.
What was the materials for glass? Because I know very little about glass making, except I think you need sand and we ain't near a beach. So what were they using to make the glass?
They used pebbles. Around here, you've got quite a large bed of pebbles. They're white pebbles. Now, you've got to crush them because you've got to have them as fine as possible. So what they would do, they would put them into the furnace at a lower temperature. And this was called fritting. And what that did, it made them brittle so they could be easily crushed. Once they were crushed into like a sand, then they add the bracken and everything else into the mix and then cook it at a very high temperature, which then melts to form the glass.
Wow. Do you know what they, obviously once they've made it brittle, do you know what they crushed it with?
The pebbles were very brittle, so they didn't need a massive amount. So they would just literally crush them up with a giant mortar and pestle and or grindstones, anything just to grind it down.
Would they have moved a kiln site to be nearer trees? Would those sites have moved around, or would they have brought the wood to the kiln?
Very much it was transient. They needed vast amounts of wood, about an acre every 10 days of wood.
Oh my God, that's incredible.
Plus bracken, which if you go to the Chase, there's lots of bracken there. So they had been denuding the sites as they went along. So they would move. And again, if they had other, there's other sites locally near Rugeley, there's Coton over at Etching Hill, there's another site there. So they moved around and then obviously moved back a couple of years later and the trees are grown again, so off they go again. So they were moving around all the time, just following the raw materials they needed to do it.
Hi, my name's Emma Kirkham. I'm a local glass artist. I actually qualified in 1996, so coming up to 30 years now, I guess, practicing in glass art.
And you come from Hensford?
Yes.
But for most of your glass art career, you had no idea that this was an incredibly important place for the history of glass.
No, because back in the day when I was studying, we didn't have access to internet. It was the good old library that you went to, and it's not very cool to be seen in the library when you're a student. So, there's better things to do with your time than go and sit in the library. So it wasn't until I'd been to the Netherlands, and I worked as a glass artist in the Netherlands for 13 years, and back in 2012, I started to pack up and I moved back to the UK in 2013. And it was after moving back to the UK and living with my parents again, I started to look into the history of what was going on. And just by sheer chance, I came across all the different things that were going on Cannock Chase back in the 13th, 14th, 15th century, and it opened my eyes to a whole new way of glassmaking.
That wants you to make some kind of furnace joke. I feel like a fire was lit underneath you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, let's use the puns where we can. Yeah, so it did light a fire inside me to research more and find out a little bit more about the importance that the Cannock Chase played in the glassmaking industry. And how much of that glass actually went around the world. Predominantly, I think the most notorious pieces ended up in York Minster. So that was really exciting to think that the window glass that was being produced back then is still there at York Minster now.
And what did you find out about the techniques? And I mean, obviously, I'm guessing it's very different from glass production today, but what did you find out that surprised and excited you?
I think two things. How you produce glass today in terms of studio glass in a small furnace, they were doing the same thing. So in some ways, it's not changed at all. Obviously, the way we create window glass as we know it today is completely different. The way it was produced then was by hand, and they'd be producing things like crown glass. What you'd find in your really old historic buildings, you know, that kind of circle with like literally a bullseye in the centre that you can see, that's where that was attached to the pontili, and that was how they created and opened up the form from like the circle into a flatter piece of glass. And then obviously they then started to produce what they called muff glass, because it was a long cylinder cut at both ends, and it was like the old-fashioned muff that people would put their hands in, and that would be then cut down the centre, folded out, and that would create more of a sheet form of glass. So although glassmaking has changed over the years, we still do create glass in a very similar way as glass artists today. So, yeah, lots of differences, but also the bare bones of it, how it was originally done, is still how we do things as a studio, a glass artist today.
It's fascinating to hear about the little-known legacy of glassmaking in Cannockchase District, but not all these stories are ancient history. My next stop is St Luke's Church to learn about some slightly newer and beautifully crafted stained glass windows.
My name's David Gethin. I'm a lay minister here, or a reader to use a technical term, and I'm licensed to perform worship, or I can take part in funerals. I can't marry anybody or baptise them. So I've been here for almost 50 years now, or in this parish, and I got interested in the stained glass windows during the World War I remembrance years. And I didn't know a lot about our stained glass windows, so I set about finding out. And what I found interesting was not so much the windows themselves, but the story behind the windows. So, for example, this is our oldest window. So
we're in the vestry now.
And we're in the clergy vestry.
Okay, this is the backstage bit. This is the bit you get to see, but we don't.
That's correct. Okay. This is why very few people see this. But this was put in when the church was extended in about 1880. The window was sponsored by a man named Ewan Christian, quite a nice name. And Ewan Christian was a very famous architect. He became the president of the RIBA. He designed the Royal Portrait Gallery, Carlisle Cathedral, and many others. So he had a thriving London practice, and he lived in London. But what happened was his mother was visiting relatives, because their ancestry is in the Isle of Man. And she was on her way on the coach, and the coach passes by Cannock and Rugeley on its way to Liverpool. And it seems unfortunate she died.
Oh.
Not very good at all, so they obviously decided she needed to be buried. They didn't want to take her back to London, so she came to Cannock, and she was buried in the churchyard here. And I've got a record of the burial certificate, which I found. And we think that Ewan Christian was at one time the architect for the Diocese of Lichfield. So he knew all about Lichfield, he knew all the churches, and he obviously heard that Cannock was being extended, and he thought it's a good time for me to put a memorial in to my mother. And this is it, this lovely little window with stylized oak leaves and mistletoe, and the two emblems at the top sort of signify his evangelistic faith.
Absolutely beautiful, a lovely tribute.
It is. I always say it's the prettiest of the three windows. They've got all the mistletoe along the side, which of course people sign peace deals under the mistletoe as a sign of peace.
And have a little kiss at Christmas.
Well, that's it, bringing love and peace. To one another, aren't we? So that was put in the 1880s.
Beautiful. Where are we going next, David?
Well, if we're going to the east window, because this was the next one to be put in. And this is the first of the three windows that were put in by the Loxton family. Now, the Loxton family were a very up-ranking family in Cannock in the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. And this is dedicated to Charles Loxton's father, Samuel. Now, they came from Wensbury. Their father was a wine merchant in Wensbury.
A wine merchant in Wensbury?
Absolutely.
I bet there aren't many in Wensbury now.
I wouldn't have thought, well, you never know.
Never know.
That's underground. But Charles and his father had practices in Walsall. Charles was a solicitor and Samuel was an architect. But in the end, they came to live in Cannock and they lived on the New Penkridge Road, a house called Shoal Hill House. That's where they lived. When Charles got married, he built a house in front of that one, which is called Ferndale. And there's a little road called Ferndale close next to it. Both houses are still here. And both of them then, when they were in Cannock, they both attended this church. But he died in 1895. If you have an east window, it has to feature Jesus.
Is that the rule?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. It has to feature Jesus somewhere. And so there we see him right at the forefront there in a nice bright red tunic, standing out against the crowd, and the angels above with a crown, crowning him king of heaven, king of the earth.
It's a very beautiful window, and it is very busy, isn't it? Unlike
yes.
the first one you showed,
yes.
which is very simple.
Yes.
And as you say, Jesus is at the centre. I mean, that red is technicolour, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, that is so bright.
Well, it's symbolic of royalty.
Okay.
It's also symbolic of blood and the passion, the red of blood. So that's why it's red there. So on the left, we've got some Old Testament figures. You've got Moses and David. And if you notice the tablets that Moses is holding, the Ten Commandments are no longer there. It's blank.
Oh.
Because Jesus, he hasn't replaced the Ten Commandments, but he superseded them with his two laws, love God and love your neighbour as yourself.
Simplification.
Both of those can be found in the Old Testament as well, to be fair to say. And then on the right, you've got St. John and St. Luke.
And around these central figures, the design and the patterns
yes.
are really intricate. And again, very bright. There's a lot of sort of bright yellow and gold. And actually,
yes.
just behind Jesus, there's a rainbow and some beautiful clouds and some rays.
That's
and
right.
there's a real kind yeah. of, you know, there's a real joyous feeling
well,
to
yes.
it, isn't there?
As you know, it's in the rainbow. If you get a bit closer and look at the rainbow, can you see something different about it?
Well, it begins and it ends with violet.
Yes.
So normally it would be
red orange,
yellow
green, blue, indigo and violet.
And what is
so
this?
We don't know why they put that violet one at the back, the indigo, violet at the top. We don't know.
Yeah. That's it for this episode of Cannock Chase Collections, but that's not the end of the glass story in Cannock. Next week, we'll find out how religious persecution temporarily revived the glass industry. Emma Kirkham describes the different types of glass production, both old and new, and we take a look at another window with a moving story in St. Luke's Church. A big thank you to the National Lottery Heritage Fund for making this series possible. Of course, thanks goes to our guests as well, and to you for listening. If you'd like to discover more, head over to the Heritage section of the Creative Chase website at creativechase.co.uk and explore more stories from the Cannock Chase collections, from coal mining to social history, from industry to health and well-being. Until next time, keep well, keep curious, and keep celebrating the stories that make Cannock Chase such a special place.